Hello and welcome to another episode of the Animation Industry Podcast. My name is Terry, and this is a very special episode for me because it is episode 250. Wow, I never thought I would get this far. I never even dreamed of it. I started this podcast back in 2018 when I decided to switch my career away from business and marketing and go to animation school and study animation. And I started this podcast as a way of connecting with people in the industry and learning more about what this industry has to offer. And wow, it's been 6 years of running this almost every single week. And after all that time, I've decided that it is finally time to move on. I have a couple episodes left to post, which I will be posting in the next couple of weeks. But after that, I won't be posting every week anymore. I may still do some special episodes here and there because there are still people that I want to talk to in the industry still. But this is just a heads up that this podcast is coming to an end. So I just want to say thank you to all of my listeners. I know there are people who have been here since day one and listened to every single episode, which is crazy, and I'm very appreciative of you. I think it's also amazing. So thank you for joining me on this journey of my life, basically, and my career. Wow, it feels great to have come this far and chatted with so many wonderful, wonderful people who have just, you know, given so much knowledge. And I feel a little bit sad. I feel a little bit emotional because this has been my life for 6 years. Every single Tuesday, after I finish work, I start the podcast, and sometimes, like today, you know, I work on it until midnight. I connect with people every week. I schedule podcasts. After work, two or three times a week, I'm talking with people. I've decided that it's time for me to move on. So I'm incredibly grateful for this podcast and all the incredible and rare and unique opportunities I've gotten from it. And also a super thank you to everybody who has listened to all of my ramblings over the years. But I'm very grateful that you tuned in every single week. And if this is your first time tuning in, sorry, but this podcast is coming to an end. But thank you for all the messages that I've received over the years. It's been so encouraging and heartwarming to know that there are so many other people around the world who tune into this every single week. So thank you so much for listening and following my journey. And I'll be sharing more in the next couple of weeks. Now, this chat is with Rand Fishkin, the creative director and CEO of Snack Bar Studio, which is a new video game studio formed by Rand, who is actually a little bit better known for his entrepreneurial endeavors in the business world through the company he founded called Moz, which is an SEO software used by virtually every business out there that uses SEO, and his current company, which he founded called SparkToro, which is a demographic intelligence and market research tool. Now, in our chat, Rand shares how he switched from the business world. Well, he's actually still in the business world, but he's also switched into the world of video games at the same time, I guess, to found his studio, and the extensive research that he put into figuring out exactly what kind of video game to make to set himself up for success. Also, the team he's put together to make the video game the best it can be, and exactly how much all of this cost, as well as a complete rundown of the business model for funding a video game that he has gone through. So without further ado, let's jump in. Hello, Rand. How are you doing?
Good, Terry. Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
I'm excited to chat. It feels a little bit full circle with my previous career and following your whiteboard Fridays or whatever they were, and applying some techniques to my own career and whatnot. So here we are talking about video games all these years later. What the heck? Also, behind you, are those the Adventure Time
characters? Yeah.
Characters, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So Geraldine, my wife, made these for me for various birthdays and Hanukkahs.
Oh, wow. She hand-painted them.
Those are hand painted. Yeah.
That's amazing. They're really cool. I like that.
Yeah,
I like
thanks.
very relevant for an animation podcast. Okay, cool. So, all right. You are known in the SEO marketing demographic space as kind of this guy who started some really big companies that have kind of changed the sphere. But lately, this past year, you have been working on a video game, which is completely different than like when I first, I think I saw it on LinkedIn and I was like, what? Well, how did this work? So tell me, I guess, give me like a 30 second, like the transition between like entrepreneurial business marketing stuff into the realm of video games.
Yeah, sure. So I started a couple of companies, one of which I think you're pretty familiar with, called Moz. I started that right out of college. I actually dropped out of school, and Moz became a very big player in the SEO software space, so search engine optimization, sort of helping people get their sites ranked in Google. That business grew to a couple hundred employees, $50 million in revenue, tons of venture capital raised. And I was CEO there until 2014. And then I stepped down. I remained at the company for another 4 years, which was a quite frustrating and challenging experience. And then left slash was kicked out, depending on your perspective or who you ask, in 2018. And the next day I started SparkToro, which is one of the companies I run now. SparkToro does audience research, so helping people understand sources of influence in a particular sphere. So if you want to know what podcasts do electricians listen to, or where can I reach people who do indie game dev, SparkToro can tell you all those kinds of things. And that company is going nicely over $1 million in recurring revenue, tiny little team of three people, not venture capital funded,
wow.
Funded in a very, very unique way, which I'm happy to talk about. And as of last year, my wife and I, Geraldine and I, started a video game studio with a few co-founders. So Nicholas Kraj, who's sort of well known in the games field. He was the lead game designer on some of the Assassin's Creed games and Just Dance and a whole bunch of stuff at Ubisoft. He was at Focus for a little while. Not Focus. I can't remember his second company. Anyway, he joined us at the end of last summer, and we've got a lead developer, Miriam Cabrera, who's in the Canary Islands, and Francesco Mazza, who's in Florence, Italy. So we have this nice little team of co-founders that are making a video game, which is still a few years away, but that's been a really exciting pivot and new project. And I'm doing it simultaneous with SparkToro.
I mean, this sounds very exciting. I'm very curious why you decided to get into video game in the first place.
Yeah.
Because, you know, all your experience is one, you know, starting companies, running companies, building companies, that's an experience in itself. But the types of companies is totally different because, like, you know, one is geared B2B, people looking for growing marketing and target audiences. And the other one is engaging consumers, you know, it's entertainment, completely different. Like, you know, what gave you the confidence, I guess, to be like, I have all this experience here, and I think I can also make a successful video game.
Well, so I want to be clear. I do not have the confidence to
Great.
Develop
okay.
a
Who has
video
the confidence?
Game. Yeah, no way. By myself. Definitely not, right? I think if this were a, you know, me and Geraldine type of project,
yeah,
it would not be possible. But what I did feel confident about is, one, I think that the market opportunity in games, especially sort of the mid-tier of indie games, I think is just incredible. I think there's so much opportunity there, but because of how the institutional structure of funding and development and returns in the market work, nobody is interested in games that make between $2 and $10 million. Like, there's just no interest. Nobody wants to fund those games. So very few people start those types of studios. Very few studios are set up to have any type of success if they make a game that sells, you know, that type of thing. It's really be limited to sort of people who get lucky and like a couple of friends get together and do a game in their spare time, or they like save up enough money to quit, but they don't raise any money. And maybe a publisher finds them, maybe they don't. That mid-market indie sector, I think, is completely underserved. I think there's literally hundreds of millions of players around the globe waiting for a game to come out in their favorite genres. And if anything looks interesting, they'll hop on it. But it, so few polished indies come out in that mid-tier market that it's just underinvested in. So
it sounds like you've already done a whole bunch of research into
how to
get funded and what the market looks like. And you're right. There's, I mean, like classic Stardew Valley is like, you know, I remember like finishing Harvest Moon and still playing it on the Super Nintendo as an adult, being like, I really wish there was something more. And then of course, like Concerned Ape comes out with it, and I immediately just bought it. And now it's a classic example. But you're right. Yeah. There's a huge gap of like these indie, like, you know, mid-tier games. But there is a big problem of, you know, how do you get together a team? How do you fund these things? When the big companies, they're not focusing on that because the return is so small. And the little players, like individual people, are just getting lucky or falling to the wayside. So you said you started this with your wife. Were you just like cooking one day and you're like, you know, it'd be great if we were cooking in Italy in a video game. Let's do it. Like where does the inspiration come from?
Yeah.
So you're already running other businesses, and, you know, running Spark Toro is a small team and you're trying to build it, et cetera. I'm assuming that's taking a lot of time. Why a game suddenly?
Yeah. So I got particularly obsessed with the idea of making a video game and sort of just interested in the market, and also obsessed with a small collection of these sort of mid-tier indie games. Yeah. Stardew Valley was definitely one. Hades is another, but even the other Supergiant titles from before that, a little game from a couple of guys here in Seattle called Undermine that I thought was really clever and creative. Night in the Woods, right, which is kind of a classic and indie tier. So a variety of these like inspirations, often from small teams. And then I got obsessed with the market. So I just started reading everything I could about the games industry, having conversations and calls with people who I sort of knew from the software world who were in games, right? A friend of mine in Seattle had gone on to lead some of the teams at Unity and then left there and, you know, has some interesting things to say about that company. We know some folks who've been at Valve and worked on Steam and that kind of stuff. So as I was exploring this world, I was like, gosh, you know, this not only feels like a really interesting thing to do from a creative perspective and like fulfills a lot of passions. You know, I love narrative storytelling. I have no artistic skills, but I absolutely am in awe of people like yourself and Francesco, our artist, who can do these type of things. And so this was just of deep interest and passion to me. And then my old company, Moz, the one I started like way back in the day, finally sold. Somebody bought it. Private equity company bought it. I hadn't been there in years, right? And I had been off the board of directors for a year, but I got this call and it was like, hey, there's going to be a big check hitting your bank account. I was like, holy shit. You know, so I remember when that went through, you know, I said to Geraldine, I was like, wow, I think the budget for our game just got real. You know, it went from like, hey, let me see if I can find like one, you know, one developer and one artist, and we'll sort of like work together and make a little thing for maybe $500,000 or less, to, hey, why don't we try to do this thing for real? And so that kind of kicked off this process where we initially contracted an agency to build the game. And that process started quite promising and then got mired in some challenges. I think the agency basically got other clients who were higher paying and more important. And so we fell by the wayside for them. But we did manage to build and recruit this team and get these exciting people on board. And so now it's going forward as a full project. As to the time piece, so you're right, most of my time is spent on Spark Toro, 70 or 80% of my working hours. The good thing about having no skills in the video game world,
you don't have to execute anything.
Yeah, you don't have to, right? The team doesn't need you for anything, right? They're like, look, what we need you to do is sort of assemble the right players, be a good leader and listener and sort of manager and right? Get the right people on the team, inspire them to do their best work, give them the tools and ability to do that work, the freedom and flexibility to work how they work best, make sure there's enough money in the bank, go raise money if we need to raise money, all those kinds of things. And those are things that I know how to do. So it's been a good match.
Ta-da. Interesting. I want to talk about something you brought up earlier. You said, you know, before you got this big check in the mail, which is congratulations also.
Thank you.
You were like, I'll just spend about $500,000 funding a game, and it's not going to be serious.
Well, yeah, and I want to be clear, right? That $500,000 would be the budget over three or four years, and that was going to come out of like how much. Obviously,
like that money can quickly disappear as soon as you hire two people full time over four. Like that's it, basically. Exactly. But on another hand. That sounds like a lot of money to somebody who is, you know, how do I get started? So like, where would you be raising that money? You know, especially because like, you don't have any experience in video games. You're not an artist. You have nothing to prove yourself or track record to be like, I can, you know, I made these other a couple of video games and they turned out successful. I know the space. I know how to make an engaging game, blah, blah, blah. Obviously you have a track record in a completely different aspect. So where's the money coming from, and how are you convincing people to be like, hey, you trusted me for this other project. Now you can trust me in a completely different way.
Yeah, I think this is an absolutely superb question. And I'll be totally honest. We have not yet raised the money for this game. Although I have some already committed investors who are sort of on board to back it. I think the way I would answer that best is the people who believe that we can do this are going to be relying on three things. Like one is Rand or Rand and Geraldine sort of trustworthy people who have a history of doing the thing they say they're going to do. And that, right, that at the core, I think the last, you know, sort of 20 years of my work history helps to answer that question. And, you know, we've delivered nicely. The second one is, have you assembled a team of people who can successfully represent the answer to those questions about like, hey, what other games have you made? What have you worked on? Prove to me that you've got sort of a track record. Nicholas obviously has an incredible track record, right? Like if you look at his games.
You knew him personally or?
I did not. During COVID, when I was doing it, my obsessive research into Games World, he posted something on Reddit, a few comments. And I loved the way he talked about games. I thought he sounded so thoughtful and considerate and realistic. He brought this just incredibly refreshing perspective. He runs a community called GD Keys that helps aspiring game designers better their craft. And so he's worked with, you know, thousands of people in the game industry and, you know, obviously advises a bunch of other teams. And so I reached out to him and we started up a relationship just over some conversations and phone calls and that kind of thing. I called him as an advisor. I think I paid him like $300 for a couple hours of calls, right? To like learn some stuff. And we really clicked. Like it wasn't just the Reddit comments, you know, we were clearly best friends from our like first hour of phone call.
Cause my other question was going to be, how do you reach out to a random video game designer and be like, hey, you don't know who I am, but
yeah, that's exactly it. I sent him an email. I was like, hey, you don't know who I am, but I saw you run this community. I'm thinking about making my first game. You know, won't have much of a budget, but I'd love to contract like an hour of your time to chat because I think you just have really good perspective on this. So we had an hour long phone call and he sort of gave me a bunch of feedback on this stuff. And it was clear that we gelled really nicely. And so fast forward to, I think maybe 9 or 10 months, Italy opened back up to travel, right? Because it was closed during COVID. And Nicholas had moved from Paris to the Ubisoft office in Bucharest in Romania because he had met a girl there and he kind of fell in love. They're engaged now. And we were in Italy visiting some friends and I secretly arranged for Nicholas and his girlfriend Juana to fly to meet us in Umbria. And so, yeah, we were like staying at this lovely hotel, empty hotel, right? Cause nobody's visiting Italy yet, but we were staying at this empty hotel in Assisi, in Umbria, and Nicholas and Juana just show up and Geraldine was there like, oh my God, you're that guy from, you know, I surprised her. I didn't tell her he was coming.
Oh my goodness.
Anyway, so we had like a lovely, like 3 or 4 days where we traveled and ate together and did a cooking class and stuff. Just had an incredible time together. And we realized there was something there that we wanted to partner. And so that sort of started the experience. And Nicholas kept his job for another, I think, year and a half after that. And then finally I convinced him, like, hey, let's do this for real. Like, let's build a company. Let's build a whole team and make this game a smash hit.
You know, if I've learned anything from, well, business and art, it's like when you're authentic about what you do and what you want to do, you just naturally meet other people who are also authentic about what they do and want to do. And it's exciting and you bounce off of each other. Okay. So getting back to my question, the first thing is you're a trustworthy guy. The second thing people I look for, do you have the right team? Totally makes sense to me. The third thing
I think is, why this game?
Yeah.
Right. Like, why is this game going to be compelling to an audience? Why is it going to have the possibility to sort of return its investors' capital and potentially, you know, fund enough of a studio that you'll have the budget to make DLC and sequels and, you know, cross post media to do other things? Geraldine's talking about writing a book in the universe where the game takes place. And potentially she's an author, right? So she's got an agent and relationships with publishers and those kinds of things. And, you know, could we do graphic novels? Could we do other types of art? And I think the answer to that question has to be a really unique value proposition. And so for Snack Bar, it's a few things, right? One is a relatively unique setting. So we're setting the game in 1960s Italy, in a small town where you, the chef, the player, run a restaurant with your brother, and you go out and forage and fight monsters in these magical wilds around the town. And then you come back to your restaurant and cook very iconic traditional Italian dishes for the people of the town. And so this this game leverages some things that are very familiar, right? Sort of that roguelike loop, which is a, you know, has a nice hook to it. It's also a relatively inexpensive way to create significant amounts of content without massive amounts of work, right? Because you can reuse assets and levels and environments and all those kinds of things. And we think that the other big piece of this is going to be the quality of the narrative and the art and music, which have a sort of combination of, you know, Geraldine's unique voice. She's a James Beard award-winning food writer. So that sort of helps us there. And is now a best-selling author as of last week with her new book.
Congratulations. I saw that as well. Congratulations to her.
Yeah. Thank you. She's she was just on Kara Swisher's podcast on Monday and was like this, you know, she's blowing up, which is incredible. Right. So a big part of this is bringing together talent that can do these things. I think Francesco's art, you know, he obviously is Italian. He's from Sicily, lives in Florence, but he does, you know, these just incredible shots of the wilds and the towns of Italy. And I think that those combined are going to create something quite compelling and unique for our type of player, who I think is an older player. I think they're more folks who grew up with sort of the 90s, early 2000s style of games. And this game is going to feel familiar and comfortable to that crowd. And it's also going to be, you know, it's single player. It's not particularly complex. It is action oriented, but not massively difficult, which turns off a lot of sort of older, you know, over 40s players, those kinds of things. So we're trying to hit our target demo, and we don't have to clear a massive number in order to have a positive return for our investors. I think that's the last piece.
My questions before I ask them.
Sorry.
No, it's totally fine. I keep talking. I have a bunch of questions. I think you brought up a good point about, you know, why do investors care and why is it this game? A lot of people just want to make art for the sake of, I have this really great idea in my mind. I've always wanted to execute it, and that's great. But when you're asking for money, the people giving you money are going to want, you know, a return. Why am I giving you this money? What am I getting back? Which I think I'd like you to talk a little bit about why you chose this idea, because it sounds like you have some experience, and the people involved, are tied to Italy and cooking and all these things. Did you find some, did you like, oh, I wish we could make a cooking game in Italy and it would be amazing, and then try to workshop that to fit a demographic? Or did you do all this research and go, oh, you know what? There's not a lot of cooking games out there. People, Italians love food. 1960s hasn't been hit yet. Where did it can all converge? Because
Yeah.
like you
No,
said,
Terry, I did this work where I listed the countries with the largest player base on Steam, right? So it's the United States, China, Japan, Canada, the United Kingdom, Spain, France, Italy. And then with the exception of France, every country's favorite non-national cuisine is Italian. So I
Interesting.
looked into, as we knew we wanted to make a cooking game, right? And so Italian was the way to go. Italy is also the most commonly, what do I want to say, romanticized travel destination by people in those countries.
Right.
With the exception of China, which more romanticizes France than Italy.
So you don't have your heritage is Italian. You're like Nona grew up making you like the best, I don't know, Parmesan,
Geraldine is
whatever.
Italian,
Yeah.
right? So Geraldine speaks Italian, which
Well,
obviously was a
that's a huge help.
yeah.
So you
But
actually reverse engineered what what are my interests, or what are the interests of the two people who want to make a game, and kind of tried to fit it in with what you researched and found to be lacking, I guess.
yeah, I mean, I'll tell you that a huge part of the inspiration or a huge part of the initial idea for the game was playing Hades and realizing how fun but underdeveloped the fishing loop was. So in Hades, which is for folks who haven't played, it's a relatively challenging roguelike game, but with a very strong narrative story, superb writing, excellent voice acting, inspired by the works of Madeline Miller, who wrote this incredibly popular book, Circe, and another one, The Song of Achilles. And but both of those books, were smash hits, right? Just absolutely huge. The Supergiant team didn't use the books directly, but I think they had the insight to say, gosh, this world of Greek mythology sort of retold in a new setting, that's extremely compelling. Let's use that idea in our game. And they did leverage the romance between Achilles and Patroclus in the game Hades, so you can, as the player, sort of reunite these two lost lovers in the underworld. It's really sweet. But the game also has this like little tiny element of a chef in a kitchen, and you bring him fish that you catch in the underworld, and then he gives you little rewards, right? And he's cooking there. And as I was playing that piece, I was like, ooh, there's something right here that could be turned into something really exciting. And you can read online, right? There's a lot of people who sort of talk about that aspect. So, look, when it comes to all of this and the idea portion of the game, I do worry that a lot of, I don't know whether our game is going to be successful, right? So it's very tough for me to say at this point, hey, you should do what we're doing. But I will say, I think that putting a lot of effort and thought and research into molding your idea to something that appeals to consumers has a hook, has a line, has a sinker. Right? For us, the hook is this, the setting, right? It is very compelling for many people from a romanticized, nostalgic perspective to imagine rural 1960s Italy. Like, that's just romanticized setting. So that helps. And then we're using something that's very concrete and familiar in games, which is go collect a thing, food. Go make something from it, crafting, right? Ingredients, recipes, and then make money, in our case, the old Italian currency, lira, and use that to make your character more and more powerful and do it over and over and over again. And then, so that's sort of our line. And then the sinker for us is going to be the narrative, right? The narrative and the art. And we'll obviously we have to deliver on that in order to have something compelling, but I think we've got a quite reasonable shot. And my biggest fear when I look at, you know, a lot of the, like indie game dev stuff, especially on Reddit, is I'm like, oh man, I think you are an incredibly talented artist or a fantastic animator or a wonderful game designer. But I really worry that you didn't spend a bunch of time in the, why is this pitch going to be compelling to both players and investors? And I don't think you can, unless you're sort of independently wealthy and don't need investors, you do have to appeal to both those groups.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, yeah, you brought up a really good point. And a lot of people, I think, lack exactly what you said. You know, it's really exciting to make a game, and it's become easier and easier, but it's hard to find, you know, still gaps that exist. So 1960s Italy sounds, I haven't heard of a game that takes place there. So already that's going to stand out. And if you have the execution, then it's going to, fingers crossed, be successful. You mentioned, you know, going to investors. How are you finding these investors? You know, you're like, you have a lot of experience doing this, but say somebody's listening and they're like, you know, I have a couple of friends. I have a, you know, an engineer, a designer, an animator, blah, blah, blah. But like, we're doing it in our spare time, but it would be great if we could do this full time and hire more of a team. So like, where are these beautiful money giving angels?
Well, so
where are they?
I want to be fair. I talk about this a lot when it comes to SparkToro, right? Because people ask, how did you fund SparkToro if you didn't raise venture capital?
Right.
And the answer there is, it was my personal network, right? Over the previous sort of 17 years at Moz, I had built up a lot of people, mostly in the digital marketing and entrepreneurship and software development, Seattle tech world, West Coast tech world, people who knew me, liked me, and trusted me, right? They were like, oh, you know, Rand Fishkin, we've seen his work online. He sort of, when he writes about things, he tends to tell a good story or be right, or, you know, do a good job. Like he feels like a trustworthy person, those kinds of things. Right. And so is that audience building that really helped. And I will say this, I have seen a lot of artists. In fact, I interviewed, my God, I probably interviewed 150 artists over the last 6 months. And I saw a lot of people who had built up incredible audiences, you know, people who had tens to hundreds of thousands of followers on their, you know, combination of Instagram or some people on Twitter, right? A few people on Mastodon had built up a nice following there, or Threads or whatever. And in all of these cases, ArtStation as well, right? In all of these cases, my sense was that they had not sort of turned that or leveraged that into a, I have my own projects and, you know, I'm going to use this community of people who love my work to gain some, you know, find the few people in there who might want to fund and back it. A few times I do see this mostly with crowdfunding, but I don't think it's not normal. Like it's very unusual to do this. And so it's really hard. Like one of the things I want to change in the next few years, Terry, not just with Snack Bar, but with SparkToro as well, and some other companies that Geraldine and I have invested in a similar way. There's one in food tech, for example, that we invested in. And the idea is we raised, so I'll give you the SparkToro numbers, 35 angel investors invested $1.3 million, so between $10,000 and $100,000 each. And we used that $1.3 million to essentially build the product and grow the audience for the product that we were building. And when we launched, it took us not that long, about 9 months, not even 9 months, to get to profitability, which is, you know, break even profitability. Like we didn't have big salaries or anything at the time, but our documents, our funding documents said basically, we can, as we grow our revenue and profits, we can repay our investors, and then Casey and I, the two founders, can pay ourselves significantly more. We could basically double our salaries once we repaid our investors their initial sum. And then anytime we want to pay out dividends, those dividends go to the owners, which include our investors. And so my hope is, you know, next year, 2 years from now, we make another, you know, $1.3 million payout in dividends. And our investors are like, wow, you know, I'm getting my money back, and I make, you know, 20-30% of my money every few years on this company. This is kind of great. Like it's like a dividend stock rather than a growth stock in the public stock market, but for a small little tiny startup. And I think that model needs to be normalized. So that's what I'm hoping to do in the games world. I've talked to a few people, you know, who have significant presence in games industry. I think I had a call with Nick Button Brown from the UK, who's sort of a very well-known investor in games world. I had a call with David Kay, who's a well-known investor in California in games world, and some other folks. And I, like, my pitch is, I think that this, you know, a lot of these small creators, small teams can do things incredibly cheap, can do wonderful work, beautiful things that'll resonate with players if they're just given a chance. And so what I'm hoping is, if Snack Bar can be a success, it can also be an example that people point to and say, hey, I should fund my studio that way.
Yeah. I mean, wow, you said a lot.
I did.
I have some thoughts. And the first one is going back to when you said, you know, you've interviewed artists with tons and tons of followers. There's this like misconception that you need to like Patreon yourself or like sell stickers or like get your general following to support you, which is totally fine. But, you know, it's interesting. You have, I don't know, how many hundreds of thousands of followers do you have over all the platforms, but 35 people funded your company. It's not like you asked for a dollar from every person. You went after so quote unquote whales to say like, listen, I'm going to do something serious. Would you like to fund? So like, I know people who have no following, but they have the right following, if that makes sense. Like their connections, yes, are super valuable, important, versus like somebody, because there's this, I have a lot of thoughts. There's this like, as an artist, you want to have a million followers, and that seems like success to a lot of people, but like, it's, what does it mean? What is it actually getting you? So I think it's interesting how you're funding this. And so like with Snack Bar, it's the same as SparkToro as well, right? You went to individual, well, you said also you had some stuff, well, I'm assuming stock
from equity. Yeah. I mean, Geraldine and I do plan to also be investors in Snack Bar. Yes. I'll give you the rough plan right now. We think that to make this game and get to early access will take about $1.5 million.
Right.
So that, but if I'm wrong, I don't want to be in a situation where it's like, oh no, it took 1.75 and we ran out of money and we had to close down the studio. So the plan is to raise 2.5, which is a very modest budget for a small studio, but obviously pretty significant if you're just a, you know, team of two or three people trying to make it a small game yourself. It, again, it's that like that sweet spot that we were talking about earlier of the mid-tier indie market, yeah, that I think is so interesting. And my suspicion is that we will raise externally 1.5 and put in a million ourselves. That's my, you know, hope, knock on wood. Fingers crossed, our like financial advisor person is like, how about you put in a little less than that and raise a little more? I'm like, okay, I'll try, Greg. I'll do my best. But the hope is basically that we have about 2 years of production, maybe a little bit less, get to an early access launch, prove out the game there, build some buzz before we go cross-platform from Steam to Switch and Xbox and PlayStation, those kinds of things. Yeah, and, you know, Nicholas and Miriam and Francesco have all been through this a few times. They've done it with other games. And so they have a lot of experience here. Gotcha. And I'm learning from
them. I do want to be cognizant of your time, but maybe I'll just ask you two really quick questions here. One is, what is success criteria for this game? You've hinted on a couple times, you know, if it's going to be a success or not, but you know, $2.5 million or 1.7 or 1.1, et cetera, that's a lot of money to put into, as well as time, 2 years to put into a game. What is the success criteria? You know, you've mentioned payoff for investors, et cetera, DLC, books, et cetera. What is success criteria for you for this game?
I think the minimum bar is the game makes enough money to fund the studio's continued existence and development of a sequel for, you know, 2 or 3 years after that.
Gotcha.
That's not actually that high a bar, right? So if you were to sort of say, hey, show me 100 games that were made by similar-ish size teams, similar-ish funded games, how many of them have made, you know, $2 million or $1.5 million or more in sales in their first year? And like the number is decent. It's significantly better, for example, significantly better than venture-backed startup world, which has a 7% survival rate after five years, right?
So, video games are also still kind of new, and venture business have been around forever. Okay, so success would be enough sales, that's the bottom. Yeah. Okay. And of course, upper success is the world. So that's great.
I mean, I would love to make a game that sells, you know, Stardew Valley types of quantities. I don't think that is going to be the first thing that we come out with. That's very unlikely. But I do think that numbers like something like Dave the Diver, right? This is a very similar game loop, is similar in concept. Could we hit numbers like that? Potentially.
Yeah. Everybody knows about that too. I mean, it would be great. So that leads into my second question. What is the marketing plan for this game? You know, this is a classic Rand question, but this is a different world. Are you planning on like slow burning people on social media until you come up with a launch, doing behind the scenes, you know, going to all the conferences, you're getting in the magazines? Like, what is the underground guerrilla marketing on Reddit? Like, what's the formula you're going to go with?
I would say it is primarily digital. I like conferences and events, and I do a ton of them for SparkToro. I have been to a couple. We went to PAX West when it was in Seattle. I like conferences for networking, and I like them for if you need to find a publisher or if you're hiring people. I don't think they're a high cost effective way to bring players to the game. I think they're expensive for that. So yes, I think that, I would say the first thing we're doing is leveraging our personal networks, which are luckily quite significant, right? Geraldine has a huge following. I have a sizable following. Those people are not in games world, but the nice thing about games is they appeal to everyone. And so it kind of doesn't matter, right? Like people who follow me for, you know, tips about company building and entrepreneurship and digital marketing are like, ooh, cool. They've signed up to the snack bar email list. So great. Yeah.
And too.
I think the same thing's going to be true, probably even more so with Geraldine's audience, because they're very interested in sort of food, feminism, Italy, you know, that's like her whole universe.
Gotcha.
And then I think the other thing that we're going to definitely do is quite a bit of community social media marketing, right? So I think there's going to be significant online efforts to build that through sharing lots of behind the scenes, sharing lots of video, lots of artwork, all that kind of stuff. And then I think it is underrated to invest in traditional media. When I say traditional, I guess what I mean is media that is not necessarily inside games world. I have seen some interesting looking results from things like people getting on NPR or being featured in the New Yorker or having their work talked about by, you know, a popular Substack in the in a space that has nothing to do with games. And my theory is that we can leverage a lot of stuff in sort of food and travel world into games world, as well as pitch a lot of the games publications where people go to pay attention to this sort of stuff. And through that, kind of build buzz from both sides.
Gotcha. I mean, this sounds pretty straightforward to me. Is it a full digital launch and then finding traditional media? That makes sense. Cool.
Yeah. I mean, SparkToro, this is what SparkToro does, right? SparkToro's whole goal is like, where does my audience hang out? What do they pay attention
to? You're going to use SparkToro to figure out your strategy.
I mean, you can literally, you know, you can take Stardew Valley's website and plug it into SparkToro, and then it'll show you like, oh, these podcasts are what they listen to, and this is the other games they follow, and this is the, you know, sort of sources of influence they pay attention to. So I'm a little bit cheating by using my own.
It's not cheating. I mean, I've typed stuff into SparkToro before just to see what's up.
Yeah.
it makes sense. I mean, what better tool to use than your own tool that you built specifically for that? So yeah. You know, I don't want to take up all your time, but is there anything you want to share still that we didn't quite hit on, or?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, the one thing I want to say to sort of studio owners and folks who are joining studios and folks who are experiencing a really tough time in the video game world right now, because I know it's an awful, awful time. Like I'm insanely grateful that we have this structure that lets us sort of operate outside the bounds of how traditional financiers think about video games, because frankly, I think they absolutely bungled the last few years, and now everyone in the industry is paying the price for that. But I'm going to say this, which is games compared to software. Like when I saw the salaries in the video game industry, when you know Miriam and Nicholas and Francesco talked to me about what their salary expectations were, my jaw dropped. I was like, how do you live? How does anyone in the games world live? Like you've been in SEO, right,
Terry? Not just games, but all of animation.
Yeah, all of animation, right? So like, you know, what Netflix pays, what the BBC pays, what Amazon Studios pays is criminal. But it is because the demand to be in those industries, the prestige and the desire and the interest to be in those fields is so high as compared to, you know, something like boring SEO software, right? Where it's kind of like, oh yeah, you know, it's a job, but I'm not excited about it. I mean, I personally am excited about it because I like doing that stuff, but for a ton of people, it's not. And this, I think, is where you kind of have to go in with your eyes open realistically. And if you can find that angle of uniqueness, like I think there's something really beautiful and special about being able to specialize or becoming known in an area, having some tie to other fields, having some expertise.
The music for this podcast was composed by Willem Mando and the graphics by Luhan Wang. I encourage you to look them up if you enjoyed their work.
You know, newsletter or a very powerful social feed, those kinds of things can help you stand out in a really crowded space. And I just want to say I have a ton of respect and so much empathy for people who are in this world. I hope that we can make a little tiny difference in our own way the next few years for folks who are struggling.
Yeah. I mean, that's a really positive note to end on, but you're totally right. I mean, we chatted about this beforehand, but even my experience in school is people come out of school and they just want a job. And sometimes, you know, I've seen people take, I've seen studios directly take advantage of new grads by offering them way below even what they're offering other new grads, because they just, people don't even know, which is crazy. I remember when I left my SEO job, I consciously thought this is probably the most money I'm ever going to make in my life. Cause I already had looked into salaries for animators and I was like, I have to make this move for personal reasons anyways.
And I fundamentally think this is unfair. There's, you know, one of the reasons that with all my co-founders, right, that I want those folks to own a stake in Snack Bar Studio so that when we make dividend payouts to investors,
yeah,
the founders are rewarded as well, right? Like Miriam, our lead developer, she should get paid whenever our investors get paid. I think that is fundamentally fair. I think it's totally ridiculous that capital is disconnected from labor so tremendously in this world, in all worlds, but we can change that, right? Like we have the power. I think if studio owners in particular take a stand on how they want to raise money, they're willing to sort of raise less from non-institutional investors, right? Not private equity, not venture capital, but individual angels who have to sort of conform to the structure that you know, that's going to work for us. And they're willing to accept a lower amount of risk for a lower amount of return, which I think is quite exciting in our new era of, you know, it's the end of cheap money, right? With the Fed raising the interest rate. And so suddenly earning 5% on your money becomes appealing. 10% on your money becomes appealing instead of, you know, what it was previously. So.
Yeah. I am very happy you brought that up. I think that's a fantastic that you're doing that. I mean, especially in this industry with animation, like in the US, I'm in Canada, but in the US, at least there's animators are unionized. Right. But like just how voice actors get paid or like physical models get paid, you know, they get royalties every time something is aired, every time something is shown. But as an animator, even a show creator, there's some show creators who they make more money by voice acting in their own shows than they did by coming up with the idea, animating it, et cetera, because like animation is kind of just treated as this, this cog in the wheel with so replaceable, and it's crazy. I'm commissioned for my own style, like sometimes I've had big brands come to me and they want my own style and whatnot, and they just pay me one time fee and that's it, and then they show it like on TV forever, and like I don't get paid anything for that. So I full wholeheartedly agree with what you're doing. I think it's incredible. And so yeah, Rand, thanks so much for coming on the chat. It's been really insightful and fast-paced chat. I wish we could talk longer, but yeah, so thank you so much.
My pleasure, Terry. Thanks for having me.
Of course. And if you're listening and you want to reach out to Rand or follow Snack Bar's development, you can do so by checking out snackbarstudio.com or head over to Threads and follow at Rand DeRuiter or at The Everywhere Stuck. And I'll include both those all those links in the description of this chat. And that's all for now. So thank you so much for listening. Okay, bye.